And you weren't yet taking these orchestration classes or whatever.
I didn't take... I never took formal lessons with Jacques.
Okay.
So then I go to... So I'm hanging around, and he's doing the Guild of Composers stuff. I'm also, at this point, I'm studying composition with Mario Davidovsky. Mm-hmm. And I'm writing, composing music with his elaborate 12-tone ideas going on. Which are too complex to describe to most people.
Did you care whether people heard it or not?
Heard my music?
Yeah.
No. Mm. Not really. I mean, the performance is nice to get a performance. Kind of, because it seemed to be a way of you know, measuring your career. But I didn't have the... I mean, I had a friend, Bart Bartholomew, is a very good composer, and he used to say that, you know, he didn't consider the piece done until it was performed. And my attitude about that was, the performance, that's going to involve some uncomfortable scenes. I'm going to have to go and talk to these players, and then there's going to be the actual concert, and people are going to want to talk to me about this stuff. I didn't really... I looked upon that as a necessary evil, as a part of the career.
Do you think Jacques did?
Had the same attitude?
Mm-hmm.
I think Jacques had come to feel that way.
But he didn't start off feeling that way.
Well, he had been one of the greatest performers.
He'd been a performer.
Yeah, he was the foremost conductor of contemporary music for decades.
And Schoenberg.
You know?
They were interested in beginning performing.
And was Schoenberg interested in having his music performed?
Yeah.
I think so.
Very, very, very much.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting that it came down to where you were.
I think also, you know, the problem for all of us was most likely the performances weren't going to be very good. And that was the beautiful thing about the Guild, was you knew that the performance was going to be good.
Wow.
Because those players had all been trained by Jacques. You know, he trained an entire generation of players, and they were all tremendously serious. And so you were going to get, you were going to hear what you wrote. Or if they played it, you know. Like, every dynamic, every nuance was going to be articulated, and the piece was going to be thoroughly studied.
Right,
because these guys, because they were artists. They were also artists, these performers. Mm-hmm. Guys like Alan Bluestein, the people who were in Speculum Musici, all these guys, they were artists, and they would devote the amount of practice time needed to perform the new piece of music by the young composer, because they were artists and that's what they did. Mm. They were also making a lot of money playing Coca-Cola jingles, but that wasn't their art, you know. And there was very much an idea that art was not something that you did for money.
Where does this idea come from?
But that art is something you do for money?
That there's something you don't do for money. That would make it religious. In the earlier area.
Yeah. It comes from the religion thing.
Yeah. Which is odd, because of course those musicians that did it for religion also were also simultaneously doing it for money, whether it was...
Yeah.
Palestrina was under the pay of the largest payer you could have at that time.
Well. Yeah. Although, you know, I was just having this conversation the other day about, because I was saying to a young musician that I was talking about how intense it is to play, to be the musician for the funeral of a dear friend. Mm-hmm. And how this becomes, this really will straighten you up pretty quickly about the larger scope of things. Because it's not about you, you know, in that situation. It's really not. You're attempting to express some, you know, this group, this culture, this little society, these people.
Neither is a Bach cantata.
Right, you know, and you're trying to do this, so you're trying to express something for these people, you know, and you need to bring your skills and all your talents to bear to try and and do that. And, you know, in that case, but that brings up another big question that, that with regard to me, which has to do with the ethnomusicology thing, because there's also a heavy ethnomusicology influence on me about, and so I had this idea of what I really wanted in life was to simply be the musician for my tribe, whatever that tribe might be. Of course, finding amenable tribes is not always so easy to do. But, you know, to be a part of a musical world and to function in that in some kind of natural and unforced way.
Are you really a tribalist?
Am I a tribalist?
And do you really believe that that's a system that tribes and...
I don't know. I use the word tribe. I don't really mean, like, the technical usage. I just sort of mean, like, groups of friends and family or whatever, you
right.
know.
So you wanted to function in the society.
In the society, as a musician. And not, you know, because also the other thing about the academic music, I mean, you know, there are all these guys and we're writing this music and, you know, nobody's mother came to the concerts. Nobody's mother certainly went home and listened to this music that we were writing, you know. My brother had absolutely no use for it, you know. He was genuinely hostile to the that entire thing, you know.
Your actual tribe really had no
interest. They hated it. They were just like, if they came to a concert, then I would get this like lecture from them about, what the fuck, this is bullshit, what the fuck are you doing? Why are you doing this? This is stuff, this is stupid, and it's insulting, and they were just largely regarded as, and so we wouldn't talk about it. You know?
What did they like?
You know, Springsteen. Springsteen, Paul Simon, Elvis
like
Costello.
That too, right?
Yeah, I do. I like that stuff just fine. I got no problem. And I do that sort of thing. You know, I write pop songs and all that sort of thing. Yeah.
Do you think they would have thought less of you if that was the only thing you did?
What, if the only thing I did was the academic music?
No, it was play Springsteen type stuff.
Who, my friends and family?
Yeah.
No, I think they would have thought more of me.
Really?
I think they would have been more amenable to listening to what I was doing, because by the power of suggestion, it would have... You know, this is one thing I think I've learned. Power of suggestion has a lot to do with the aesthetic experience. Tremendous amount to do with the aesthetic experience that people have.
Uh-huh.
You know, if people are told that this is the real deal shit... they're much more likely to take it as being the real deal, or, you know, and have an aesthetic experience. Just like if you tell them that this is some very expensive wine, I shouldn't have told you this was cheap wine, I should have told you, Jonathan, oh, the Norwegian lady brought me this fantastic, these grapes only grow, they're only 1 month of the year in Norway, blah, blah, blah. In any case, you would actually taste the wine differently, right? And this, I'm starting to realize, this has a lot to do with music as well. And so, in a certain case, with me, I think I've confused people because they find out that I'm into something else. That is, I'm not just into the music that they're into. I'm into some other kind of music as well. And that then casts suspicion on all my activities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, wait a second. He's got a doctorate from Columbia University in music. He must not actually be musically talented, because only an asshole would bother to do that, you know. Instead, what I should have done is, you know, just drank a lot and played the guitar loudly.
Do you think that a lot of the cachet with Schoenberg comes from the fact that he wasn't he wasn't an institutionally taught composer and ended up at that quality level?
I think at that time, no, I don't think so, not initially. I think at that time, there weren't that many institutionally taught composers. It wasn't that...
Really?
That, well, let's put it this way. When I was at Columbia, they had just instituted, not that many years before, the doctorate in composition. And the master's hadn't been that around for that long, because it was thought that that was something that you could train. And there were conservatories and such at the time of Schoenberg, but none of them had formal training like that.
Uh-huh.
You know, Brahms didn't have formal training like that. You know, I mean, it was guys who took lessons with guys.
Well, they apprenticed. Yes.
They studied with somebody.
But you know? There had been. I mean, especially when you're talking about
those schools managed to produce thousands and thousands and thousands of composers whose names we don't know.
They did. Yeah, that's when we're into the the Gallant stuff. That book we're
yeah,
the book now that's really
there's a great book of the prize winning fugues from the Paris Conservatory. Yeah, and some of the guys in there are famous, and it's like years and years of guys you never heard of. You know.
So again, though, this is what's curious, though, is that we're back into being into the people that get heard and fame, and you know there is a correspondence between Bruce Springsteen and a famous composer in terms of
this fame. there's these cultural environments that exist, and the Academy is one of them. You know, because there'll be people who are famous in the Academy, or in their particular circuit of the Academy.
Yeah, interesting.
You know, but they aren't necessarily like. You know how many times I run into people who have been trained as composers by somewhere?
Yeah.
And they go, oh, I studied with so-and-so. And I'm like, oh, I never heard of that person. Mm-hmm. And then I say, I studied with Davidovsky. And they're like, I never heard of that person. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, absolutely. And so within the world of the academic music, there are these different, like if you go to Florida, there's a set of guys that are different from the guys that are regarded as the guys in Southern California that are different than the guys who are regarded as the guys back up at Columbia and Princeton and, you know, Harvard. And there are all these different little fragmented worlds, and they all those worlds think that they are the absolute shit.
So it just strikes me now, okay, so all of these, now we touched on something, all of these things that have to do with your introduction to the composers and contemporary practice and composition, all of the things that lead to those positions are based around ideas, whether it's true, whether it's not. There's a whole lot of philosophy connected.
Right.
And I'm not going to get into whether that's...
Or anti-philosophy, which is philosophy.
Which is philosophy, too. I'm glad you said that. It's sort of one of the premises of the interviews that I'm doing. Now you're back out. We've gone very deeply into being in Colombia and this world. And clearly, I'm not trying to make it shallower. You can go deeper into that if you want. But you now are back out to things like Wayne Kramer and the scene in New York, and back out playing with Steve Bernstein and things like this.
Right.
And you already suggested that there's a level of phoniness in there and a level of realness. So there are people that are connected with actual revolution and people that aren't. So in other words, again, we're into an idea behind music that creates its relevance.
Yeah.
So again, here we're into things that create the relevance for the sound artifacts.
Yeah. Which is like that power of suggestion thing, huh?
I guess. Maybe. I'm asking. I'm just saying that you know we're into a parallel idea here. One of them is more real because it's directed. It seems to me what you're saying is more direct its relationship with the current.
When
the
you
band.
Get into this thing of like, well, once you realize that the power of suggestion has such a strong impact on the aesthetic experience, then the question is, are you willing to admit that is a universal human condition that applies to us as well.
Do you think that?
So, like, maybe I only like Schoenberg because it was billed to me as such. You know, it came in with the heaviest of credentials. Although there was a time in my life when I didn't like Schoenberg that much, and I recall having conversations with people where I was advocating Scriabin. Uh-huh.
That's really funny. Great, I love that discrepancy. So, do you think now, in the first thing, the way this started off, all this started off in the interview was had to do with coherence creating scenarios. And so, in light of that, are coherence creating scenarios, are those in a sense a chimera? Those are nonsense. Those are a fiction.
They are. Well, you know, you've studied with me, so you've probably heard me say that most. I think that music theory is, by and large, harebrained crackpot schemes cooked up by mildly schizophrenic people.
Do you think this helps the case of thinking that music is a good idea?
I think that music is. I look upon all these things are natural artifacts of the human mind, mm-hmm. right?
Okay.
And you can find harebrained crackpot music theorists in like a lot of different cultures. Like mm-hmm. it's not just us,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
You go off and you read about the God help you with the Arabic stuff, you know, like the Maqam and the Dastgah, that gets really, and the Rags, and it gets to be, you know, there's lots of harebrained crackpot things that then create these hypnotic oral artifacts
mm-hmm.
that we listen to. And this is one of the reasons why, one of the things I'm interested in is not so much why people like music as why they don't like music.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, what music don't they like, and why do they not like that music?
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Is there anything you don't like?
Oh, yeah. It depends on the time of day and stuff. But yeah, no. I will go through. I will have students in and go through long, arduous, philosophical, aesthetic things about the meaninglessness of opinions, the uselessness of opinions and criticism and value judgments. And after all that, then they'll play me something they'll like, and I'll be like, "Ah, that's terrible. That's awful. I hate that stuff."
So backtrack, I interrupted you there. Okay. So now
I'm kind of into, here that kind of ties, there's this thing, English prime, which is like this form of English in which you don't use the verb to be. So you wouldn't say something is something. You'd rather always say, "I feel that something."
Right.
You know, you'd always make sure to clarify between the objective and the subjective. And I guess that's more of what I'm trying to get at.
They go further with that. Those,
you know, I think that maybe without
the distinction between
there's no music without that's objective. Can't be. It may be the case that there's not even any math that's really objective, that it's all subjective. But that's a different realm of stuff. Back to Minot.
Okay.
Because this is the stuff we really should get on about. Mm-hmm. So I'm studying, so I'm working with Minot, with the guild, and a bunch of the guys who are working with him at the guild, because he has this, you know, little crew of young composers. And people decide, well, let's, because we know that he's working on this manuscript about this little Schoenberg piano piece. And so they decide, let's go, well, we'll go up there and we'll have a little seminar, and we'll go up to his apartment and we'll read the book with him. So I go up there the first day, and there's like five of us. And he hands the thing out, and we look at it, and it's the, you've seen it, it's the densest language you could possibly imagine. It's like he's invented his own language. It's utterly, completely mind-bogglingly confusing, and frankly, fairly terrifying that anybody's actually gotten themselves into this situation where they're writing like this and thinking like this. And so I go home, and I can remember, I went upstate that weekend with some friends, and I remember sitting outside, like by this lake, and reading this first one page, like 50 times. You know, I mean, I'd been put through the mill already, you know. I mean, I'd had to read Kant and stuff, so I was like, "God damn it, I'm gonna get through this. I'm gonna." And I went back the next week, and there were like three of us. And on the subway ride on the way home from that one, so then that one involved like people trying to ask me questions, which mostly resulted in being insulted by the guy. And so I come back the next week, and it's only me. And there was another thing. I had attended a class. Okay, this is before I started this working on this manuscript with him. I had finished my doctorate at Columbia, but I had been hired to teach music theory there as an adjunct.
How old are you now?
Oh, I don't know. This is like you're talking about like 91, born in 57. Mm-hmm. You know, one of these long academic careers, you know. And so, but he, and he was teaching a class, I think it was called 20th Century Styles and Techniques or something. And so I decided to audit the class. And so I show up at the first day of the class, and there's like 10 people in the room, and he hands out this, I forget what the piece was, but he hands out his sketches for the analysis of it and talks about it, and it was like, boom, in like an hour and a half, he laid out the piece completely, like, you know, what was going on with it, how the row forms worked, all these things about the relationships. It was just like, and it was fast, clear, and just, you know, incredible. And so then the next class I came back, and I was the only one there. And he proceeded as if there were a classroom of people. He handed out the notes, and we went through the entire semester this way. I would show up. None of the other people actually showed up. At the very end, the last class, the other kids showed up to hand in their papers. Lord only knows what kind of mindless crap they had written. Mm. Right? Because this is what I discovered also, is that a lot of people around that world were running around acting like they were knowledgeable, and they could not actually talk about the stuff. Mm. They did not actually understand it. And, you know, they were just like really posturing behind a bunch of plausible nonsense to manage to deflect anybody from actually discovering that they couldn't actually read the scores, and they couldn't actually do the counterpoint, and they couldn't actually count the row forms, and they didn't actually know what was going on in the music.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed up and they handed their papers, and then he handed out, and I recall because I remember him saying, he handed out, this is his last class, and he hands out the evaluations where the students evaluate him. And he said, and so now the students will grade the teacher. And that was a perfect summary of the end of Western civilization.
Mm-hmm,
you know, it's like he wasn't actually going to get to grade them. They were pass fail or something, you know, but they were going to get to grade him.
Mm.
And none of them had actually been in the class for the whole year, because I had been there every day, and none of them had ever shown up, ever. And I wasn't enrolled.
Mm.
I was auditing. I was just hanging around, you know. And so anyway, after that, I went to study this manuscript with him, and I came back and found myself the only guy in the room with him. And so he made the really strong pot of coffee, and he would roll cigarettes. And I was smoking at that time, so we'd smoke these horrible Bugler cigarettes or whatever, and drink the really strong coffee, and then I would ask him questions, and he would insult me for a while, and after he got done insulting me, I'd say, okay, Jacques, that's great, now, and then I'd ask him the question again, and eventually, it started to make sense to me, and I could follow what he was talking about, and I could read pages of it, and it was gorgeous. Might not be true. I'm not sure that it's the sort of thing that falls into the level of truth value. But he was attempting to delineate out of this little piece the tonality that was this that was going on in this piece. And but in order to do that, like we talk about tonality, and so we talk about like our regular C major diatonic tonality, right? But it has all this background work that's been done on it, right? So we understand that C to E is the lower third of the tonic triad. Now, because there's the C is the tonic, and the third is the median, and which is two steps away. So I mean, there's a tremendous amount of language that we don't think about, that because it's easy for us after years and years, right, to talk about it. He didn't have that kind of background of language to talk about the tonality of this piece, and so he had to invent it.
Mm-hmm.
He had to go through and work out from the little Grundgestalt the entire possible system. And so he, in order to be able to describe how this piece was an instance of this kind of tonality. And so that led to him having to go through thousands of pages of exploring every possible function and sub, like these group functions and subgroup functions and the relationship between this tone and this context and this tone and this context, and to actually chase through all of them, and which I think most people think of as madness, but I think he was really trying to articulate everything about his intuitive experience of this piece.
And Pat Carpenter thought he was right.
And by the time I got done with it, I didn't know whether it was right or not, but it was a profound experience. Really, really deeply profound experience and tremendous musical education.
Mm-hmm.
Because he would talk about things in terms... Once you realized how he was using the language, it was actually quite precise. Mm-hmm. So he wouldn't talk about the tonic. He would talk about like the final resolutive function.
Okay, that's interesting.
And he would talk about valuation and disvaluation. Uh-huh. You know, so you.
I got a lot from this valuation.
The right valuation, disvaluation. All this stuff came out of his use of language in this very clear way. Now he had also had kind of things that were sort of like that. Unless you were more familiar with the backdrop of his other work, which I actually was, because another thing I had done when I was an undergraduate was I'd gone through all the composers' doctoral theses and read them, which was also an eye-opener because a lot of them were pure crap.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the pieces weren't necessarily bad or good, but the stuff that people wrote about them was just, I mean, really... I never mind. His was fascinating. His was the one that was really, truly intriguing and fascinating. And it had to do with partitioning. And it had to do with the idea that the tritone is the symmetrical partition of the octave.
Mm-hmm.
And it potentially contains all the intervals of the octave. Because as you move up to the tritone, then the intervals that are larger than the tritone are basically inversions of the intervals that are smaller. So the perfect fifth is an inversion of the fourth. So hence it's contained inherently within the tritone, and that the valuation of the tritone then, and he worked out this whole system with these different ways of partitioning, all the different kinds of partitioning of the tritone and how they related to partitionings of the octave. And so, for instance, in that world, the octaves is not something that you actually use in say 12-tone music, because it would be a doubling of a pitch, right? And so, and valuationally, that would disvalue the octave. But in order to understand how the augmented chord functions, you have to have the concept of the octave. So he would refer to the octave as the hypothetical octave.
Hmm.
And, you know, that's something very... That takes three or four steps to begin to understand why he would call it the hypothetical octave. And he doesn't mean that it's the hypothetical octave because it's hypothetical and that it doesn't exist. He means that it's hypothetical because it's... not in the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's not in the system as a function, but it's in the system as a concept.
It creates a sonic.
Right. Value. So yeah. the augmented chord symmetrically divisions the octave, but you're not really dealing with octaves, so it's hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
For instance. Or, I mean, and he had lots of little quirky things like that.
It's interesting talking to James Blood Ulmer. And it's the direct opposite. Well, not really, but it's very interesting because, you know, I was talking to him about a particular...
Oh, we had that conversation about the octave is a different note.
But it sounds different.
Yes,
it sounds different. Why is it called the same thing? Well, this is a very interesting way.
It's a very fascinating profound thing because in many, many cultures around the world, it's considered to be the same note.
I know, but the point is actually very profound.
It is profound.
You said to me, does it sound the same? No, it doesn't actually sound the same.
But it has a different, but we give it the same name. We put it into the same category.
Yeah.
We think of it as having the same qualia somehow.
Yeah, and so, but to understand when you're talking about an artifact, what's real? What's real is that it doesn't sound the same.
Right. And I should say also the thing about the Jacques is he also went into the rhythmic structure and the phrase structure of the piece and the registers and, you know, by the time he was done, it was an amazing thing, you know, again.
Mm-hmm.
Whether
mm-hmm.
it's true or not is, well, it's art.
Yeah. And so it's creating another sound.
Yeah. So I spent, you know, after spending 6 years hanging around with Pat Carpenter talking about what is the musical idea? I spent 6 years hanging around with Minot talking about the musical idea.
Why did he think this was important?
I think he, I think, like, I think he believed that there had been an evolution in music, much the way that, like, we think of there being an evolution in physics, and that had led to this. And the book about the Schoenberg piece is only one volume of a larger work that he has in mind, because he also has wants to write about the other periods of history, including, like, from Gregorian chant and through Beethoven and Brahms and leading up to the Schoenberg. Mm-hmm. This was a tonality, like, in that sense, I think, was a major concern of theorists and musicologists in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And I think that with the advent and widespread thing, and I don't want to get too much into it because it's one of my pet peeves, but in the Schenker came along, and tonality got reduced to just this idea of the articulation of the major triad, and so the idea became that tonality there's only one tonality, and it was that tonality which is articulated by the 1-5-1 cadence with the 3-2-1 descending line. And so then you get into, you know, people thinking, saying things like, well, the first atonal piece is Tristan, the Tristan prelude. Right, yeah, exactly. You roll your eyes, and so do I. So then that was a major change in the thinking about music in the academy. In the 50s, you had people running around and looking at Arabic music and people talking about microtones and different kinds of tonalities and stuff. And then that kind of goes by the wayside, and we get this inundation of the Schenkerian guys. And then it's like, well, there's two things. There's 12-tone, in which the most important thing is the aggregate. Then there's some mushy stuff before that that you can handle with Alan Fort's set theory. And then there's a whole bunch of stuff that's really not really either one or the other, and we don't really like to talk about or think about. And then you can go back to Brahms, and it's nice and safely, and you can deal with it with Schenker.
Right. You know? Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the problem, they're all to some degree obsessed with cadence, because the question is, if you have stuff, what's the grammatical functions in everything, anything that you propose? Because, you know, they're afraid of free-floating letters is essentially what the fear is. But, and Minot is saying there aren't free-floating letters even here. The question is, it's a question of what the system is.
Of having a superior understanding of what's going on. And
right.
So that you can, or in Minot's case, I think it's more like he's doing the coherence-creating thing, but he's trying to do the same thing that Pat had done. And that is, and I think we talked about this a little bit before, about the idea of theory that eliminates possibilities or theory that creates possibilities.
Mm.
And the Schoenberg thing, the ultimate thing, is to strip it away down to the essential thing that generates, and then look at the way that it's generated from this essential idea.
Mm.
And so, for instance, Jacques was very careful about maintaining the difference between music that's complex, which is to say it is a complex of relationships, and music that's merely complicated.
Oh, that's very great. Okay.
You know, yeah. he was very adamant about that. You know, it's like there's a lot of music that's very complicated, but that does not mean that it's complex. It's easy to write complicated music.
Mm-hmm.
It's another thing entirely to write music that's complex.
Because it has to maintain coherence.
Yeah, it's because it has to have relationships and things going on in it that are, you know, that it has to, which are not relationships that arise because you're eliminating possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
They're the relationships that naturally arise out of exploring the possibilities from the initial idea.
Mm-hmm. So the observation, basically, there's the idea, and then you observe what the features of the idea
are. Well, you get your little notes down on the paper, and you start pushing them around, and you invert them, and you see what kinds of things you can do with them. You know, there's that fascinating document, which is Bach's little collection of canons based on the ground bass for the Goldberg Variations. Mm. You know, and there's like another set of canons that he just wrote out. You know, because he was exploring the possibilities of how these notes bump against each other.
Mm-hmm.
I try to encourage my students to work with notebooks as opposed to simply composing into the computer, because nowadays it's very easy to sit at the computer and punch in notes and hear it back, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, luckily, I was right at the border when I started studying with you of availability for the computer to do that. So I actually had to run with notebook. I had to at the beginning.
But I'm there's this other thing that there's this pre-composition. They would talk about these things, pre-compositional material, right? This is like a hot buzzword at one time in the world of music theory in the academy, back up east, pre-compositional material. And pre-compositional material would be like the diminished seventh chord being the symmetrical partitioning of the octave and the way that opens up different possibilities for you by reinterpreting it. That'd be pre-compositional structure that already exists, or stylistic features that are given by the general style. Mm-hmm. You know, there's things that exist that already exist as sort of conceptual musical artifacts before you compose. But Jacques would also talk about the pro-compositional. Mm-hmm. And what he meant by pro-compositional, and it'd be funny because here, you know, you say, what the hell do you mean by pro-compositional? And I'm thinking professional composing or something. And he's like, no, he looked it up in the dictionary. And he's pointing in the direction of.
Uh-huh.
Right? So he's using the term pro in a way, because he's being French and his English isn't that good. And so he was trying to figure out this word. And he looked up in the dictionary, and he probably got a French to English dictionary out. And he looked up, you know, and so it's, oh, pro. So pointing in the direction of.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so what he meant by pro-compositional is this, after you've got the pre-compositional stuff, like, what's the impetus then? The application, right? So it's the actual then, like, okay, you might have the, like, okay, the diminished seventh chord is out there, and it's the symmetrical division of the part of the octave.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But now to take that diminished seventh chord and to resolve it in a particular way, right, like a little puzzle on a piece of paper, and look at all the different ways you can resolve it, and then start working out how you can use that in a piece. That's pro-compositional. So you see what I mean? It's on the way. It's neither the simple pre. It's neither the pre-compositional musical or pre-existing musical artifact, nor is it the actual surface of the piece. Rather, it's in this realm where the composer is beginning to manipulate the materials.
Mm.